You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Lester Carter Jr. has been serving his community since the late 1960s when he purchased a neighborhood pharmacy in Milwaukee. In his neighborhood, he's known simply as Dr. Carter. I recently spoke with him about his longstanding commitment to his loyal customers over the years. Dr. Carter, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you are not from Wisconsin originally. How did you end up becoming a pharmacist in Milwaukee?
I'm originally from Omaha, Nebraska, and I spent, after graduation from high school in 1949, I enlisted in the U.S. Navy during the Korean War. I spent 4 years in the Navy, 2.5 years on the USS Tortuga in charge of the sick bay,
mm-hmm.
and prior to that, after graduating from Corpsman School in Portsmouth, Virginia, I was assigned to the Naval Academy, where I spent about 9.5 months in charge of the orthopedic ward, and my job was to get the football players, the injured ones, back out on the field so that they'd be available for their next game. And during that 9 months, it just so happened that the biggest game of the year, of course, Army-Navy game, came up, and just so happened the Navy won. And, boy, the coach was up congratulating me for getting the guys straightened out and back out on the field. And he asked me, I don't know how many times, would I like to go to the Naval Academy? And I said, no, I just got out of boot camp. And I was on the second floor of the infirmary, and I could look down and see them marching. I said, no, I don't want to go back through that. And so he kept telling me that he could make 5 appointments from the regular Navy without congressional approval and so forth and so on. I said, no. So at the end of that time that I spent at the academy was up, I was assigned to the USS Tortuga, an LSD landing ship. And we were responsible for taking in the landing boats when they had an invasion. And I was involved in all the major invasions in Korea. And our well deck would hold about 6 boats. Each boat had about 30 either Marines or soldiers, depending on who was involved in the invading forces. And in between time, when we weren't involved in carrying in invasion forces, our job was to clean up the mines. And, boy, that was
wow.
A hideous job.
I bet.
Sweeping up all these great, big, ugly mines and taking them back to Yokohama where the Army base there would detonate them. So after all of that transpired and I got out, and then I decided, well, heck, I've been involved in the medical end of the work all the time I was in the Navy. I think I'll go to pharmacy school, because one of the people in the community that was, I would say, probably held in the highest esteem was the druggist. I like to call them druggists, because that's what they were mostly referred to in those days. Had a little fountain where all us youngsters would go after school. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go to Creighton, give it a shot. And boy, did I never dreamed how tough it was. Holy mackerel. I got out on a mustered out on a Friday, started to Creighton on Monday, 18 hours inorganic chemistry, organic physics, calculus, all the pharmacy courses and art courses. I thought, holy moly, I'm going to go nuts. Well, fortunately, there was a fellow that lived across the street from me, was an absolute genius. In fact, he became a Jesuit priest who was good enough, kind enough, whatever, to help tutor me through that freshman year. And then after that, I said, boy, I think I can make it. And there was a close family friend who was about two classes ahead of me at Creighton, had moved to Milwaukee and taken over a little drugstore on 7th and Walnut. And when he'd want some time off, he would ask me to come up for the weekend and so that him and the wife could spend a little time away from the store. And after, oh, 4 years that he was there, one Saturday night, the store burned down
oh, no.
to the ground. It was in a common building side by side with a pool hall. The pool hall went up in fire, and of course, drugstore too, and it burned down. So then he moved over on 8th and North at Sanger's, and then he started contacting me. We need some help. Come on up. And I said, well, wait a minute. I did my internship at a Rexall store, which was, of course, in those days, king of the road, before Walgreens and all the other chains took over. It was Rexall. So after starting out there with some of the most important jobs, mopping the floor, running the fountain, and cleaning up the place and deliveries. And then I come out of Creighton, and lo and behold, they offered me a job in the pharmacy department. However, they decided to relegate me to the compounding area because in those days, I would say a good 70% of the prescriptions had to be made from scratch and compounded. Suppositories, creams, and various types of elixirs and all of that all had to be made from scratch.
Wow.
And the pharmacists just hated that, as a polite way to put it. And with me available, well, now let's let Carter handle all of that.
Oh, no.
And we won't have to do it.
Well,
so that's how that got started. And then after about a year of being asked to come here, I finally decided, oh, heck. I've been there for a few times to help John out on in his little store. Maybe I'll go up there and give it a shot.
Well,
I never left Omaha.
I want to bring you up to Milwaukee now, and I understand you're working in a mainly German American neighborhood. You're an African American pharmacist. What happened?
When I came here, I worked at the little store with John for about 6 months, and I said, I want to get my own store. Get your own store. Well, you're in Milwaukee. It's mostly a German town. You don't know nobody. You won't. I said, well, let me give it a shot. So I talked to the manager of McKesson's here, and he says, I got the perfect store for you, Carter, over on 24th and Burleigh. And I said, well, okay, let's look at it and see what it's all about. And of course, he told me how to get there, and of course, I got lost, and where is this store? He said 24th and Burleigh. Okay, I finally made it. So we got together. The whole sale was handled with a handshake. Now, can you imagine that in today's world? Looking somebody in the eye and shaking their hand and consummating the whole sale? Well, that's the way it was taken care of.
We'll hear more from that interview with Lester Carter Jr. after a short break here on Central Time. We continue our recent conversation with Lester Carter Jr., a community pharmacist who's been serving the Milwaukee community for nearly 60 years. We pick it up with Dr. Carter describing the pharmacy he bought and what the neighborhood was like at that time in Milwaukee.
Now, the only fly in the ointment was the neighborhood at that time was about 70% German. Okay. Here I'm a black pharmacist from Nebraska coming into a German neighborhood to run a store. And, of course, when the patrons start coming in, well, my goodness, that guy back there is black. Well, does he know what he's doing? And the owner that I bought it from, the previous owner, was a German, speaking German from Wisconsin Madison Pharmacy School, named Arthur H. Mehl, M-E-H-L, German, speaking German.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, "Okay, Carter, we gotta do something here, so these people have some confidence in you. They don't have any confidence in you." I said, "Well, what do we do? What do? Stand on my head?" He said, "Just do exactly like I tell you." I said, "Okay." He said, "When the ladies come in the morning and looking around, German ladies, he says, you look them directly in the eye and stand straight and tall and say, 'Wie geht's, mein Frau?'" I said, "Well, yeah, okay. What does that mean?" He said, "That means good morning, ma'am." I said, "Well, how about when the fellows come in?" He said, "You do the same thing, look them in the eye and say, 'Wie geht's, mein Herr?'" He said, "That means good morning, sir." I said, "Well, what have I got to lose? I'll give it a shot." So the next morning, I said that to the ladies and then to the men, and they all got Mr. Mehl aside and said, "You know, that guy can't be all bad if he speaks German." And from then on, it was nothing but love.
Did you end up learning more German than just hello, ma'am, hello, sir?
Oh, a few words.
A few words here and there.
They were convinced that I was all right. If I could greet them that way, that pretty much convinced them that I can't be all bad.
That's great. Well, I understand that you think of yourself, you're not, you know, not just a druggist, you're not just a guy who fills that prescription. You try to help people out with their whole health, preventive, some alternative, things like that.
Absolutely. My thought was that so often, and of course, it started to crop up more often than not, ladies would come in and say, "You know, it's time for school to start, and little Junior here has got this ringworm in the scalp, and we've used all types of medications that we got from the dermatologist, and internal as well as topical preparations, and nothing has worked. And he can't get back into school because the school nurse says it's contagious stage and consequently won't let him back in. And that means I got to stay home, I have to work," and on and on and on it went. So Carter goes to his chemistry books and does some review and studying about how to put together an antifungal agent that once and for all would be safe enough to use with young people and yet be effective enough to clear this stubborn problem up. And that was one of the first preparations that I formulated, which, by the way, now includes about 12 different combinations. And once they started using this and the word got around, "You know, I use that antifungal cream that I got down at Carter's down there, and in 10 days it was cleared up. Never seen nothing like it." So then, of course, now I get requests for all over the state and every place else. And to this day, 30-some years later, practically 40-some years later, I would say, nothing has come along from the big pharmaceutical companies that's been more beneficial than any of the 12 different preparations that I formulated. One for the scalp ringworm, one for psoriasis and eczema and shingles and razor bumps and keloids and on and on and on.
What part of running your neighborhood pharmacy brings you the most joy?
Satisfaction, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when people come back, like now, I still work about 4 days a week, and they come back and say, I'm the third generation, fourth generation, you took care of my grandmother, and you did this, and when I had this, that, and the other, and was a baby, you cleared it up, now here's my grandchildren with this problem. That's what brings satisfaction. When you have people from two and three and four generations coming in now saying that various members of the family were treated by me, and now I'm treating their grandchildren, great-grandchildren, whatever. That's what brings the satisfaction.
And you're still going, like you say, generations
in.
I'm
still working. I go in my old store Monday, Thursday, and Saturday, and the new owners, Hyatt, they have about 10 or 11 stores. I go in one of their stores on Friday and help them out there and give them advice and different things. So it keeps me busy, keeps me out there. And that's the only, from my standpoint, as long as you can do this kind of work comfortably and not be in pain or whatever, then I want to be working. And I think that contributes to a longer, more productive life as long as you keep working. And speaking of that, by the way, I was just informed about maybe 3 weeks ago, something like that, that I was selected to go on an honor flight, which I'll be going on this coming Saturday. I think it leaves about 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that. Goes to Washington, D.C., and a whole bunch of stuff goes on and comes back Saturday night. So I'm looking forward to that, because we're supposed to be visiting Vietnam Memorial, I think, in the World War II, and the Korean War Memorial. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Dr. Carter, I hope you appreciate that honor flight. Thank you for your service back during the Korean War. Thanks for your service to your community.
Well, thank you. And I tell you, I have expressed this feeling at, I don't know, numerous different talks at universities and middle schools and around the country, that from my standpoint, irregardless of the problems and that we have here, this is still the greatest country on this planet. And if I had to do it over again, I would enlist again, just like I did during the Korean War, because I feel that everything I was able to accomplish in life, what little that may be, is all due to having the supreme privilege of coming up in America.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Lester Carter Jr., a.k.a. Dr. Carter, a community pharmacist who's been serving the Milwaukee community for nearly 60 years. 2016 has been a long and often rocky political year. From a contentious battle in both parties to nominate their candidates for president, the rise of left-leaning politics thanks to Bernie Sanders, the fighting between eventual presidential nominees Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, the scandals that plagued both campaigns throughout their candidacies, and so much more. Paul Singer joins us now to look back at the year in politics and what it all means for 2017. He's the Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing? Happy holidays.
Well, and to you, too. Before we get to the political news, you tweeted about the sad passing today of Carrie Fisher, a picture of you meeting her.
Yeah, I met her at the White House Correspondents' Dinner here in Washington last year. And I generally those things are awash in stars, and I try to avoid them all. But in this case, Carrie Fisher was sitting one table over with her dog, and I could not resist. And a pal of mine got a photograph of the two of us. You know, if you were 11 years old in 1977,
yep.
there was no bigger star than Carrie Fisher, and I think we were all in love with her back then, and I've always admired her work since.
Well, sad news there. Well, let's look back now at the year in politics. A lot to get to. A year of surprises in a lot of ways. Looking at 2016 from 2015, what did we think? What was the conventional wisdom on this presidential race?
Well, you know, in, I guess, June or July of 2015, shortly after Donald Trump had jumped into the presidential race, I interviewed Herman Cain. And because I was interested in this notion of sort of the rise of the outsider, you know, opposed to political correctness, suddenly becoming the top candidate. And I thought it would be a flash in the pan like Herman Cain was. I talked to Herman Cain, and he said, you know, don't underestimate this guy. He's got the staying power that I didn't have. And so we wrote the story saying Herman Cain thinks that, you know, Donald Trump is the real deal. And nobody else took it seriously, and I'm not even sure I took it seriously. At the time, it was considered a joke amongst political professionals. There's no way.
We'll get into the Republican side of things. Let's take a nod to the Democratic campaign. We thought going in it was Hillary Clinton walking away. Martin O'Malley was there. Jim Webb was there. Former Republican governor. I can't remember which one right now. It seems like so long ago. And then this, Vermont senator, not even technically a Democrat, Bernie Sanders. Well, that didn't end up going quite as quickly as we thought it was going to.
Yeah, and again, this is the thing that we were, as political professionals, missing, is that we understood the political calculus behind all of these candidates. You know, we understood that Martin O'Malley was an interesting, energetic, young face, and it would sort of would be a nice position against Hillary Clinton, but we also knew that Hillary Clinton, or at least a nice contrast to Hillary Clinton, but we also knew that Hillary Clinton had locked up all the endorsements, had all the money in the world, everybody knew her, she had 1,000% name recognition, and she was the first woman president, or would be the first woman president. You know, the calculus was fairly easy to see that Hillary Clinton was going to walk away with this. Nobody anticipated the wave of support for Bernie Sanders being a, you know, 74-year-old, basically cranky old Jewish man from Vermont who is actually a socialist, not a Democrat, that somehow he would become a serious existential threat to Hillary Clinton. Totally a surprise.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking back at the year in politics and taking it up to today. And Paul, I know nobody wants to hear election 2020, but what happened here? Does that, I mean, Democrats, one word on them is not a great bench, not a great bunch of candidates. Is this a time for panic for Democrats? How are they going to muster up another good candidate?
You know, I think one of the things we learned from this election cycle that is worth keeping in mind, I have always said that campaigns are 30% message, 10% magic, and 60% organization. And what it turns out in Donald Trump's case certainly has shown us, and to some degree Bernie Sanders' case has shown us, is that if you can get it up to 30% message and 20% magic, you have a chance at winning, no matter how weak your organization is. And I think that this is something that Democrats need to take to heart, is what they need is not so much somebody who has the establishment credential, not somebody necessarily who has the tremendous resume, but in some ways, the way Bill Clinton did this in 1992, somebody who has just sort of a real ability to connect people where they are, an ability to charm the pants off of people, which if you're in the presence of Bill Clinton, it was one of those weird things like there's kind of black magic going on. The ability to really inspire people in a way that I think Hillary Clinton did not. And this is the kind of campaign they have to look, the candidate they have to look for, and it may be somebody they haven't thought of recently, because they may be someone who doesn't really have the resume in the background. It may be a new face entirely.
Well, and speaking of Bill Clinton, let's get to Donald Trump now. And one thing they had in common was, I think, coming in with Bill Clinton, before him you'd think, oh, if all this news about a candidate and infidelities came out that he had, they're sunk. I mean, you think about Gary Hart. He had an affair. He lied about it. Boom. He's out. Shame. You know, he's a respected political analyst now, I guess. But that was it for him. But Bill Clinton, for some reason, overcame that. Donald Trump, the thing, if you imagined Mitt Romney or Barack Obama and the grab him by the, you know, Access Hollywood comment. I mean, that we'd be laughing about them 4 years, 8 years later. But Donald Trump and to some extent Bill Clinton, those rules don't seem to apply.
Right, and for slightly different reasons. But for Donald Trump particularly, the reason that he was able to overcome all that is because a significant portion of the American voter basically just was outraged at the world. They're outraged at Washington. They don't like government. They sort of want to just chuck it all and start over. And so Trump's message of, well, you know, just burn it all down, whatever, sort of, you know, what do you have to lose? Sort of resonated with them. Keep in mind, the other thing is, Trump's primary opponent in this whole thing was never Hillary Clinton. It was the press and the establishment. So as long as he could simply say, everything you're reading about me is a lie, and people would be like, ah, okay, sure, okay, maybe it's a lie. Maybe it's not a lie. Who can tell? Who cares? That was how Donald Trump managed to plow through all this, is by delegitimizing everything that we previously would have thought of as a fact that was disqualifying.
Did the media and maybe some of the voters evaluate Donald Trump as an entertainer, not as the way we usually would a politician, and so he was graded on a different level in a way?
Well, I don't think the media did. I mean, if you saw the last 6 months of coverage.
Yeah,
I
but early in the Republican primary, I mean, he was giving them ratings, so they kept putting him on.
Well, yeah, but how do you not give ratings to a guy that's leading in the polls? I mean, this is the sort of grand conundrum, right? Is, can I not write a story about somebody who is packing 20,000 people into an arena, is winning in the polls, is leading in the polls, starts to, you know, show up in debates and say things that should make him go away completely, and instead it boosts his support. And, by the way, comma, he's quirky. Everything he says is much more interesting than everything everybody else says, in part because most of it's offensive. How do I not write that story? And then you can't say, well, you know, the media, what we should have done was just sort of said, well, we're not going to bother writing about this guy. Well, I'm not sure that is really what you want. You don't want us to be your judge and jury and say, we decided not to write about this candidate because we think he's absurd.
Well, and this puts Republicans in an interesting position. I want to listen to Speaker of the House Paul Ryan after those Access Hollywood tapes, I think. Or no, before that, but he's talking to CNN's Jake Tapper saying, hey, maybe I'm not aboard the Trump train just yet.
You have said throughout this process that you will support the Republican presidential nominee. Now you have a presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. Will you support him?
Well, to be perfectly candid with you, Jake, I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to. But I think what is required is that we unify this party.
That was pre-convention. So now Paul Ryan saying he's excited. He's got the Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican president. He's on board, ready to work with Donald Trump. Ideologically, they don't line up always, do they?
Well, no. I mean, ideologically, Donald Trump doesn't line up with anybody. I mean, Donald Trump is his own person. His list of issues that he ran and campaigned on was a complete mismatch of Republican and Democratic agenda items. So you're going to find a whole lot of people who are going to be 100% Donald Trump agree upon. But Paul Ryan, in his working towards his endorsement, sat down with Trump's people and presumably with Donald Trump and had several conversations about Paul Ryan's legislative agenda. And Paul Ryan told us, as Capitol Hill reporters, at the time, that he was increasingly comfortable with Donald Trump because Trump had endorsed the agenda that Ryan had already developed, you know, the issues of tax reform that Ryan really wants to pursue, some of the issues of, immigration reform that is important to Paul Ryan. These are things that Donald Trump wanted to do anyway. So when Ryan could go there with a Republican agenda and say, I want to do these things, if you back these things, I will back you. And they basically said, okay. Well, now, of course, Ryan's excited. He has a Republican president who will sign his Obamacare repeal. He has a Republican Senate and a Republican House that will pass through some of these bills that would be very difficult to do in a Democratic White House. What's not to like? And to some degree, you know, winning is the great disinfectant. Everybody wants to be alongside the victors.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking back at 2016 in politics and a little bit forward to 2017. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was the biggest political moment? What was a turning point in 2016? What are we going to look back and talk about? What seemed big will fade in our memory. What hopes, what concerns do you have in 2017? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. More with Paul coming up here on Central Time. We continue our look back at the year in politics with Paul Singer from USA Today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, to you, was the biggest moment of the year? What are you looking forward to / worried about in 2017? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, let's turn to Congress now. A lot came out of there outside of the elections. What stood out to you as the big news out of Congress in 2016?
Well, I think the big news out of Congress in 2016 will end up being preparing for 2017. I mean, the primary metric of this year was not confirming Merrick Garland as President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. That decision by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will probably have the longest lasting impact on our culture, because that would have been a Supreme Court nomination that would lean, or Supreme Court justice, sorry, that would lean Democratic for the next 20 years. Now, instead, you have an open seat that Donald Trump will be able to fill very, very quickly. That is, you know, he'll be able to make a nomination pretty much immediately. And, of course, we now have four more years of some severely aging justices who he may be able to replace as well. So the fact that the Senate did not confirm Merrick Garland, didn't even have to hold a hearing, was both, I think, an aberration in what we would expect to be normal Senate culture, and also possibly the most significant impact out of the U.S. Congress this year.
Are you looking to see, are we going to see more not normal from institutions like the Senate? Is this kind of a new normal, things that we wouldn't have thought would happen before?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
it's a vague question, sorry.
I mean, with a Republican House, Republican Senate, Republican President, you might actually see legislation happen again. That might be legislation that Democrats despise. And now, suddenly, the great hope for the Democratic Party is the filibuster, which, as you may recall, Harry Reid, the outgoing minority leader, Democratic leader, when he was the majority leader, he got rid of the filibuster for most nominees. Now, judicial nominees, Supreme Court nominees, still need to reach that 60-vote threshold. That's a big deal. But for the Democrats, now they have to become the loyal opposition party. So what you might actually see is a lot of legislating going on, but the legislating is going to be very actively basically reacting to and trying to scrub away Obama's legacy.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Willem on the line in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I just want to make a comment about the coverage of the Trump campaign. I think that, sure, he was drawing these big crowds, but it was more like the coverage was more like the circuses in town and what are the performers saying, rather than any kind of a serious political, review of what he was saying, his policies and things like that. It was more like covering like a Hollywood opening instead of a political campaign. I felt like the coverage was less than serious about the content of his programs or any policies or anything like that. They were just sort of covering his outrageous statements.
Well, thanks. Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's entirely fair. I mean, I think there is some degree to which it is true that the novelty of the Trump campaign deserved coverage and got a lot of coverage and possibly more than the substance of the campaign. But there was an awful lot of stuff. I mean, I don't remember exactly when it was, but I think it was in October or November of 2015 that I was writing stories. I had dug up Donald Trump's 2005 blog, and I pointed out that he had basically opposite positions on almost everything he was currently campaigning on. You know, we were being very clear about the fact that Donald Trump's policy positions were both fully unformed and new to him. Now, part of the problem, I will say, part of the difficulty of writing significant sort of policy coverage of Donald Trump's campaign is for the most part he didn't have detailed policy positions. He only had sort of summary positions or even for that matter bumper sticker kind of policies. He hadn't really laid out detail, so we were somewhat hamstrung. But we did say that.
And Paul, briefly, as we wrap up, what's the first story you're watching for post-inauguration day?
The first thing will be obviously Obamacare repeal, and then the next thing is what other regulations does the Republican House try to take apart? Their House Freedom Caucus put out a list already of 250-some-odd rules that they would like to repeal in the first 100 days. Let's see what major chunks of the federal government the Republicans can try to shrink, eliminate, or roll back in the first 6 or 8 weeks.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob. Be well. Happy New Year.
You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us to recap the year in politics and look ahead to 2017.